From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The sky was the limit for Christine Todd Whitman. In 1993, she was elected the first female governor of New Jersey. In 1995, Newt Gingrich tapped her to deliver the Republican response to President Clinton's State of the Union address. The nation was on a first-name basis with Christie, a rising star in the GOP. Governor George W. Bush noticed, and as president, picked Whitman to head up the Environmental Protection Agency in 2001. Then the clouds came in. After a rocky 2.5 years at the helm, she resigned in 2003. Now, this lifelong, dyed-in-the-wool Republican is raising an alarm. The GOP, she says, is being taken over by fundamentalist zealots who are polarizing the party and the nation. In a call to arms manifesto, Whitman says, the Republican Party is not just the party of the right wing, it's my party too. Tonight on Point, Christine Todd Whitman and the battle for the heart of the GOP. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you hear when one of the GOP's own, a lifelong Republican and first-term Bush insider, says the party's been taken over by fundamentalists? Who is the future of the GOP? Schwarzenegger, Giuliani, Whitman, or the hard right Christian politicians? Join the conversation tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the Bush cabinet as EPA administrator from January 2001 to May 2003. She was governor of New Jersey, serving two terms from 1993 to 2000. Her new book is It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. The sky may yet be the limit. This sounds like groundwork for more political life. Christy Todd Whitman, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So you've got a big case you're making here, Governor, and I wish you'd begin to take us into it. What's the evidence that you bring to the table of the GOP being set upon, maybe even dominated by fundamentalists and zealots? Your words.
Yeah, and I identify them as social fundamentalists because I wanted to distinguish them from the real conservatives, because I don't believe these people are. These are the people that have been doing things such as mounting primary challenges to Republicans who don't think just the way they do, Republicans who have been serving their constituents well, such as Arnold Spector in the last election cycle, someone for whom he was always convincingly reelected. There was no problem between he and his constituents, but he wasn't pure enough on the issues. And when they mounted the challenge to him in the primary, Congressman Toomey and his supporters said this wasn't just about Arlen Specter. It was also about sending a message to those other moderates in the Senate that they better get in line or they were next. And we've seen this happen over and over again across the country, where Republicans who are incumbents, who are doing a good job or not in danger of losing their seat, suddenly get attacked by someone from the social fundamentalist part of the party, saying they're not pure enough on some of these social issues, therefore they need to be taken out, even though these people may recognize that they will lose the general elections. It's almost as if they'd rather have someone who voted against them 100% of the time and a Democrat than someone, a Republican, who voted with them 85 or 90% of the time.
They may recognize they would lose the general election, but you know that the claim is being widely made by this part of the Republican Party that they won the big election for President Bush last November.
No, I've heard that, and that's part of what troubles me about the interpretation of this election, because if you look at it, all the Republicans, all of those who voted for the president, all parts of the party won this for him. If you lost any one part of the coalition, the party would have lost. And without the moderates, George Bush would not be president. My problem is not that there are very strongly held opinions within the Republican Party. It's that many of those on the social fundamentalist side won't recognize that anyone else has a right to strongly, deeply held convictions. There's room in my party for them. I just don't think there's room in their party for me.
And you write that the president's victory was, in fact, narrow enough that he really needed the whole spectrum of Republicans, that conservatives alone couldn't have done it. You say the president's 3 percentage point popular vote margin was the smallest margin of any incumbent president ever to win re-election. Bill Clinton, 8 points. Ronald Reagan, 18 points. Richard Nixon, 23 points margin in his re-election. So that was kind of a squeaker.
When Truman beats Dewey by more points, he was almost 5 percentage points. It tells you it's not to take away, and I don't say that to take away from the president's victory. It was an important victory, and he showed he had coattails for the first time since FDR. The incumbent president brought in more Republican senators and congressmen, but it wasn't a mandate. It wasn't an overwhelming victory, and without everyone voting for him, all parts of the party, it wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't have taken the oath of office on the 20th of January, John Kerry would have.
Christy Todd Whitman, what is the social fundamentalist, your phrase, yardstick that's being put up against all Republicans to decide sort of thumbs up or thumbs down by this, what you call the sort of zealot wing of the party?
Well, the most obvious are that if you're pro-choice, you're not a good Republican. If you believe you should even begin to have a discussion on embryonic stem cell research, you're not a good Republican. If you think that there's a role for the government in protecting the environment, you're not a good Republican. If you don't believe that we should amend the Constitution for only the second time ever to restrict individual rights, you're not a good Republican. And it doesn't matter if you're someone who believes in a balanced budget as strong on the record of tax cutting, strong on national defense, believes in engaged international policy, is strong against crime, has reduced welfare. That doesn't matter. If you're wrong on those other issues, you just don't qualify.
And how do you describe the shape of this wing or this group? You describe them as incredibly powerful. What's the evidence of that, and how does it present that power present itself?
Well, it presents itself when they are able to mount the kind of challenges that they do and aren't—and the National Party doesn't come after them and say, stop it. I mean, the president endorsed Arlen Specter in that primary. Mm-hmm. He did come in for him, and he defended him. But it took the president of the United States to come in, and it should have just really been the National Party chairman who was able to do it. It's not that he didn't try. He just couldn't do it. They're that strong now. And it's the fraction of the party that, before the president gave his State of the Union— had said to him, and they said it quite publicly, that they weren't going to engage in any discussion on Social Security with him until he met their test for support of the constitutional ban on gay marriage. They weren't satisfied that he'd already said he supported it. Mm. He hadn't gone far enough. And I suspect that's probably what got that line in the State of the Union message.
So you're saying the Republican Party hierarchy, I want to understand exactly what you're saying, that they may not agree with this camp, but they can no longer oppose or refuse them, that this camp is essentially dominant in the Republican Party, or they do agree with this camp, that they are members of this camp.
No, I don't think they all are, frankly. I think that there is a lot of concern now about what's been created. But when you let me back up. As soon as the Supreme Court said that George Bush was the president in 2000, mm-hmm. Karl Rove did what he should do as the political head of the White House shop, which was focus on how to get the president reelected. And he did that by focusing on the 4 million evangelical voters who hadn't gone to the polls. Mm. And besides massaging the message, the way positions were delivered and spoken about within the administration so they resonated with the base, he also undertook to meet on a regular basis. I think he had lunch once a week with leaders of some of the most conservative of the groups, the groups that require a no new taxes pledge and those other groups. And that understandably made them feel very empowered. And that's how they can get up after the election and say, we delivered this election, therefore we are owed the next Supreme Court justice. That, to me, is a scary attitude, and I think we better be careful as a party that we understand that it wasn't any one group that delivered. They were all important. The victory was narrow enough that it required everyone.
You suggest that this is an overstatement of their importance. On the other hand, Christy Todd Whitman, you yourself, in our conversation right here, are calling this group the base. Is it now the base of the Republican Party? And if it is, what does that mean?
I think it's a very narrow part of the base. It's not the entire base. But I will say that in my travels around the country, I have had so many people come up to me and say, I'm a Republican, I've been a Republican all my life, but I am very troubled by where the party is going. I'm very uncomfortable. I don't think they're going to be there for us in 2008. And that election is going to be the first time since 1952 that neither party has had an incumbent candidate, not a president running for re-election or a vice president ready to step up and run for election. It's the perfect time to step back and take a look at where the parties are going and how they are configured and what we need to do to continue to be a majority party.
What do you think are the consequences then for the Republican Party, for the country, of this hard right, strong position in the GOP?
Well, I really worry for the country because I have seen over the course of my career how this growth of these fundamentalist issues and the social issues have served to really inflame passions and have resulted in elections that are enormously bitter where you have people attacking other people in their own party, where you have very, very bitter elections between the parties. And by the way, I think the Democrats have the same kinds of challenges that the Republicans do, perhaps to a lesser degree, but they still have them between their left wing and their right wing. And it has made it very difficult for people to come together after the elections and govern. And that's the partisanship is so deep now and the divides are so bitter that you don't get the kind of policy that you used to have, the kind of policy discussions and the kind of policy advances that we really need.
You're a politician. You know when the wind's changing. Does the fact that you're stepping up with this book and this critique, is this a kamikaze flight, or do you think the wind's changing, that there's a new spot for moderates here?
Well, it comes from the fact that I've had so many people come up to me and say they're concerned about it. I've been watching it. It's troubled me. I'm in the perfect position to talk about it because I've been both a governor and a member of the cabinet. I've been the focus of some of the attacks. I understand it. And I'm not in office, nor am I running for office. So I can say some of the things that those who are currently in political positions can't say, who may feel the same way. And I'm very hopeful that people will go to the website that we have at the end of the book, which is www.myparty2too.com, and use that as a place to hear from other moderates, to begin to start a moderate movement.
Christy Todd Whitman, stand by. There's a lot more we want to hear tonight. We're joined by former New Jersey governor and EPA administrator Christy Todd Whitman. She has a new book out. It's called It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. You can join the conversation. What does it mean when one of the GOP's own and a first-term Bush insider says the party's been taken over by fundamentalists? Is the GOP following the hard right over a cliff or building a hard right dynasty? We're 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former New Jersey governor and EPA chief Christy Todd Whitman, lifelong Republican. Her charge is that the GOP is being hijacked by the far right. Her new book is It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. You can join the conversation tonight. Who is the future of the GOP? Moderate Schwarzenegger, Giuliani, Whitman, or hard right, Christian right-backed politicians? And Republican listeners, are you a moderate Whitman Republican? Do you feel marginalized, or are you rooting for the far right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Christy Todd Whitman, I want to ask you, President Bush talks a lot lately, all the time, in fact, about freedom. You point to this new, what you describe as kind of dominant wing of the Republican Party, as restricting freedom, I guess I'd say. You say, like fundamentalist movements around the world, the concept of choice, of there being a legitimate range of options and outcomes, is anathema to extreme social fundamentalists. Is there a conflict here between the rhetoric of President Bush and what you see as the push for more kind of government oversight of people's personal lives by the what you call social fundamentalists?
Well, I don't put President Bush in the category of a social fundamentalist, but you are pointing out just what concerns me, that there's a dichotomy here. These people claim to be very conservative. They don't like big government. And yet, every time you turn around, there seems to be another movement to extend government's reach into people's private lives. And while there are issues that are of great importance for discussion, the fact that you had members of the president's own party holding out the litmus test of he had to be in the right place, according to them, on the issue of a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage before they would talk about Social Security is not healthy for the country. Both those may be very important issues, but they're not linked. And for those people who think that SpongeBob SquarePants is a bigger threat to the future of the country than our educational policies overall, I would say we have bigger issues to discuss, and we really ought to focus on what those are.
Were you talking this way before the November election, or were you a good soldier for the GOP for Bush's reelection then?
I co-chaired his reelection in the state of New Jersey because I felt that at this time he is the best person to lead us in a time of conflict, and this is a time of conflict. He is someone, I know the president, he is someone who believes deeply in doing whatever he can to protect this nation. He will not flinch from that. And he is somebody who moves on principles, his principles. I may disagree with him in some of those areas, but overall, there's more I agree with him on than disagree with him.
But if Karl Rove is his main man, you describe this as Karl Rove's strategy to kind of put this this crew in the driver's seat. He and the president are joined at the hip. We're in the reelection effort. Doesn't it come back to the president? If this is as serious a problem as you describe, the president's no fool. He knows the political, you know, game that was set in motion here. Doesn't some of this rest on his shoulders?
Yes. I mean, you cannot say that he has no responsibility. Obviously, the buck stops here. But, you know, he is focused on national policy a lot more than on the political process.
More than on re-election?
Well, he left much of that in the hands of Karl Rove. Now, I'm not saying he didn't understand what was going on, but as far as actually focusing on it and being part of those meetings and things, he left that to the political shop. That's what they do, as he focused on the other issues. But I also believe that he believes very sincerely that he can bring things back to the middle. And I think they've underestimated a bit of what they've created here. These people feel very empowered. They look at the president and they say, right, you're in your last 4 years. We're here now for the foreseeable future with redistricting for the Congress. It's going to be very hard to unseat many of the new congressional members. And they say, we're going to be here longer than you will, and we got elected on this kind of a platform. But the interesting thing, Tom, just to give you a couple of statistics as to how evenly divided the country is, which is another one of those warning signals to me that Republicans oughtn't to think that we have suddenly taken control of everything. There are 49 states that have bicameral bipartisan legislatures. Mm-hmm. Only Nebraska doesn't. And of those 49, in the lower house, Republicans control 25% of them. Democrats, 24. In the upper houses, the Senates, the state Senate, Democrats control 25, Republicans 24. There's 7,315 legislators across the country. 50.3% are Republicans, 49.97% are Democrat. That's a difference of 4 seats nationwide. That's a very evenly divided country.
And you're saying if you ride on the fringe as your backbone, you may lose that.
You're going to lose people. You're going to lose people. And I also think you happen to put yourself in a position where you can't get good things done for the country. But you're also going to lose people. So if what you care about is being able to ensure that your principles and philosophy of government are what's dominant, you better be careful here.
We're talking tonight with Christy Todd Whitman. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I've listened to this for about 20 minutes. I heard Governor Whitman talk for an hour on the Terry Gross Show on NPR. Not one word said against the president, despite the fact that on the issues that she's identified, stem cell research, the environment, constitutional amendment, gay marriage, individual rights, Social Security, this president has taken a hard right position. And I really don't understand this last statement that he wants to go to the middle. Is it a middle position that he's taken with respect to Social Security? I'd like to hear the governor have, despite all the shabby treatment that she received as head of EPA, I'd like to hear her say one thing negative about this president.
There's the challenge. Christy Todd Whitman.
Sure. Well, George, you know, I have said that I disagree with him on a number of those issues. But part of my whole philosophy and approach here is I can disagree with someone and still respect that they're part of the party. There are other issues that have overriding importance. These are important issues to me, but they're not the only issues. And while I'm not shy of saying that I disagree absolutely with the president's position on stem cell research, on abortion, on a number of those issues, I respect his right to have those opinions, and I believe that we can find a common ground in the middle. The reason I say I think the president wants to go back to the middle is you heard him say in his acceptance speech, and you heard him say in the inaugural that he recognized that there were people who did not support him, and he wanted to bring them back, and he knew he was going to have to work for that. I believe him when he says that. He was a uniter, not a divider in Texas. To the point where he had his lieutenant governor, who was a Democrat, endorsed him for his reelection over his Democratic counterpart. So instinctively, I think he wants to bring people together. I just believe that it's very, very difficult to do it now.
George, did the governor make the sale with you there?
May I answer?
Absolutely.
You've you managed to compartmentalize the politics and the substance when you were asked the question by Tom about Karl Rove. Now, of course, you've fused his rhetoric and his actions. I would say that those need to be compartmentalized. There's a big difference between what the president says in these lofty speeches of his, what he actually does on the ground, no matter what the issue is. And you seem to glide right over all of that.
George, we've got to...
George, you're right about that. And I think that's what we really have to look at very carefully. And I'm a little confused right now. I heard the rhetoric. I know the man. I believe, from what I know of him, that I could believe the rhetoric. And I'm watching very closely to see how much how far he goes in moving to the right, because it's not where I would think he would want to be. I understand that in politics it's horse trading, and if you want to get something big done, if you think Social Security is the most important thing, well, then maybe you will say more about the constitutional ban on gay marriage than you might otherwise. But those kinds of things trouble me, and I'm watching very carefully.
George, thanks for your call. Christy Todd Whitman, you don't speak from any lack of experience on this, and it leaves me wondering a little bit, you know, hit me once, shame on you, hit me twice, shame on me. I mean, you write in the book that when that you had this impression of George Bush as a kind of moderate, let's reach out, work across party lines, governor from Texas, but that when you came to Washington in 2001, you say, nothing I saw in more than 15 years as an elected official or in a lifetime as a participant around politics prepared me for what I witnessed in Washington in early 2001. What was the smack in the face that you got there?
Oh, that I'm talking about the partisan politics on the Hill, the fact that there was just no ability to do business between the Republicans and the Democrats, the deep bitterness in the Democrats, over the election, the feeling that George Bush was a totally illegitimate president. And that was what I was talking about there. It wasn't the ideology within the administration. It was more how impossible it was to get things done. And the first issue where I ran into that was on the arsenic issue, where that was blown so far out of proportion to anything that had ever been being discussed. It was just staggering to me how quickly that got legs, how willing people were to believe the absolute worst of the administration, and how really bitter and nasty the rhetoric was.
So, yes, you say the Democrats were bitter, but you also describe, you said Karl Rove told you that your work at the EPA was going to be absolutely critical, one of the couple of most important prongs of the president's first term, above all else. You say that you've come to think you may have misinterpreted what he meant by that. You describe yourself going into the EPA as having walked into a no-win situation. It sounds to me like there was some shock from that side as well.
Well, I knew EPA was a no-win situation before I went into it. I actually had asked for some consideration of perhaps another post if they really wanted me as part of the administration, because EPA is a regulatory agency. And a regulatory agency usually makes most people mad, because you're either making them change behavior or spend money for benefits they may never see. And so that I already knew was going to be a problem. You were never going to be able to satisfy the environmentalists fully. You were never going to be able to satisfy business fully. You were never going to be able to satisfy all on the Hill fully. But the level, there were so many, and I mentioned in the book, in the congressional caucus and the Republican caucus, who really had it, this, they were bitter too. They were bitter about the last few years of the Clinton administration, where they felt that the Environmental Protection Agency had way overstepped its bounds and become just a group of people who swoop down on businesses and ranchers and farmers to enforce regulations that they hadn't clearly communicated to them prior to that. And so there was a feeling, we've got our own back. And as I mentioned in the book, I had a meeting with a group of the Western congressmen on the Hill who looked me in the eye and said, if we ever see a good editorial on environmental policy in the New York Times, we'll know we might as well have a Democrat in the White House.
So sure, the EPA is a controversial spot, but you say, I took Rove to mean that the work I would do in building a strong record on the environment would help the president build on his base by attracting moderate swing voters. As it turned out, you say, I don't seem to have understood Karl correctly, i.e., he above all wanted that regulatory stuff out the window for exactly the kind of congressman you described from the Western gang there.
It wasn't so much that as it was, if you're going to do something good for the environment, don't talk about it. How the message was delivered, what we talked about and what we didn't talk about. I mean, this administration, right off the bat, got through a piece of legislation called Brownfields legislation, something that allows for redevelopment of sites that have been contaminated but not to Superfund level sites that may or may not be contaminated, but had some industrial activity on them before that no one would assume the liability for and redevelop prior to this legislation. They've been trying to get it done for 10 years. This president got it done. We put strict standards for cleaning up the Hudson River that are finally beginning to move forward in spite of GE not being a terribly willing partner here. Promulgated regulations to control the emissions from backhoes and tractors that are an enormous problem for, particularly in our cities where you have enclosed spaces where there's a lot of activity going on.
We know there's a list on that side.
There are a number of good things that were done, but
and yet you left.
And
yet you left because a lot of things that you wanted done weren't done and got shoved right back at you.
Well, yes. I mean, there were, as I said, you win some and you lose some, but as long as I felt that I was making a difference and we were moving things forward, I was happy to be a part of the administration because I do care about the environment and I think it's enormously important. I left because of two reasons, really. One, because I do happen to love my husband and we'd like to spend time together and we weren't happy his being in New Jersey and my being in Washington. And then the other reason was there was a particular set of regulations under the Clean Air Act called New Source Review that apply as they apply to utilities that had been being discussed since the beginning of the administration and been a big focus. Changing those had been a major focus of the administration. Now, changing the regulations was not in and of itself controversial because the National Governors Association, bipartisan, had passed a bipartisan unanimous resolution saying there needs to be some change here. But the way the changes were being made were of great concern to me, and it came to a point where I saw that the changes were going to be things with which I wasn't comfortable. And so I stepped aside so the president could have an administrator who could sign the regulations comfortably and support them wholeheartedly. Couldn't do that.
And off you went. Camille's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Camille. You're on the air.
Yes, I've been watching this over the last several years and become increasingly concerned about what you're calling the social fundamentalists and the power they have, their 30-year or so efforts into endowing university chairs, creating think tanks, publications. The fact that also over this time period there's been the way voting districts are drawn and the changes there, Republican districts, more Republican, Democratic districts, more Democrat, diehards go out to vote in primaries, so you get your extremes elected. And the only way I have been able to see out of this is a third political party, and that where you would have some of these voting districts would – some of the Democrats in the Democratic district could join this party and vice versa. You know,
you're talking about a third party in the middle, a centrist party, Camille. You're saying a party sitting right in the middle between these two. Let's get that to Christy Todd-Whitman, and thanks for your call. Christy Todd-Whitman, how about it? Is that what you're angling for here? Are you and Arnold and Rudy Giuliani and I'm not sure who else going to set out a third way?
No, I don't think you're going to see that, and for two reasons. Although what Camille brings up is an important point, the redistricting and what it's done and the fact that the parties are really focusing on hardening their base rather than expanding their base, and that means their messages have to be ever more partisan. But the practical reality, there are two things. I mean, first of all, I'm a Republican, and I still want to try to change the party from within. But the practical reality is that this day and age, with the cost of elections, you really need to have the party structure in order to be able to mount any kind of an effective campaign almost at any level. It's not quite as necessary at the local levels. But when you start talking about senatorial, presidential, you really need, unless you're a George Soros with a group of multi-billionaires as he has, you can't really run and mount an effective campaign in this day and age as a third party. And they've never worked particularly well in this country. So that's why I'm trying to get the dialogue going and trying to get the moderates excited and at least have the conversation about taking our party back.
But you know, you've got diehards up against you. You describe them that way again and again throughout this book. What's the jujitsu that gets the Republican moderates back in the driver's seat? You seem a long way from it right now.
I don't think that you're going to change the social fundamentalist wing of the party. They're never going to be happy. And unfortunately, they don't believe that there is room for people who think differently than they do in the Republican Party. But there are enough, and I really honestly believe this, there are enough other Republicans who are of the moderate, conservative, and liberal branches of the party who want to get progress, want to get things done, who can find areas where you agree. You can respect the other person's deep disagreement on certain issues, but then you look for where can we make progress, where can we come together.
And but those people are being rooted out, as you say, aren't they? Aren't they being rooted out of committee chairmanships? They're being attacked. They're having opponents put up against them, right?
They are, and that's why we've got to fight back. That's why the last chapter in the book is it's time for a radical moderate, for radical moderates, and that's why we put that website in at the end of the book. That's why I'd want to try to get this dialogue going. And, you know, within the first week of starting the discussion on the book, we had over 1 million hits on the website. That's a pretty significant number, and we had several thousand people sign up to be part of an effort to support moderates, to start doing it at the local level. So I think there's a hunger out there for a more centrist communication and a more centrist discussion and policymaking.
We're going to take a short break. Christy Todd Whitman is with us tonight. Her new book is It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. You can join the conversation. Is the GOP really still the party of freedom? Or is it, as Christy Todd Whitman suggests, increasingly a party of restricting choices and options, a party of fundamentalism? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former New Jersey Governor and EPA Chief Christy Todd Whitman, lifelong Republican, about her charge that the GOP is being hijacked by the far right. Her new book is It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Good. Good. Yeah, I wanted to put my vote of confidence in what you're doing. I think you're bringing across the right message. Yeah, I'm an independent that was for McCain, and at this point, I'm undecided about whether to join the Republican Party to do political battle with the Christian Taliban section, or to just never vote for Republican again until their song is silent.
John, do you think that Christy Todd Whitman's kind of siren song of moderation is a strong enough weapon tool to push back against that far right wing of the party?
I certainly hope so. I think it is.
Because voters like you are out there. Christy Todd Whitman?
What I was going to say is, you know, what John's saying is what I hope. I hope that by 2008, the Republican Party can honestly consider nominating for president a John McCain, a Rudy Giuliani, a Tom Ridge, and not eliminate them because of certain positions on social and a couple of social issues. And that's what happens now. Or Kay Bailey Hutchison. I mean, there are a number of qualified Republicans who would have a lot of experience and could legitimately stand for election, but our party won't give them the nomination, and that makes no sense to me.
And why do you think your party might do that in 2008? Are the forces that you're describing tonight weakening? They don't appear to be.
Well, I'm hoping that the moderate forces will strengthen. If the others won't weaken, and I wouldn't take that for granted, I would agree with you. I don't think they are. They certainly seem to have interpreted this election as a blessing to go forward with a very strong hard right agenda. This is to have the moderates stand up and say, look, we are here. You can't win without us. And we will be heard. And we want the party back to where it was in the days of Eisenhower, the days of Ronald Reagan, who reached out to people from all walks of life and all different parts of philosophy. You know, Ronald Reagan said it best. You don't become a majority party by constantly looking for people with whom you will not work or do business. And that's what this branch of the party is doing today.
Okay. And so you say the country's at a historic juncture, a critical crossroads for the Republican Party. The Republican Party faces a momentous choice. We can decide to continue or to go along, get along, or do something different. If you cannot or do not produce a moderate in 2008 in the primaries there for the GOP, is there a point at which you, Christy Todd Whitman, throw in the towel, you opt out, or do you kind of go along and get along with this party wherever it goes?
Well, I'm not willing to concede that we're going to lose this one yet. And I'm going to concentrate everything I can on trying to bring the party back, and I'll face that other challenge when I come to it. You know, there certainly is no place for me. If the party continues to go the way it's going, they don't want me. You know, when you had recently, it's very, very interesting. Ken Melman, who's a new National Party chairman, chose as his vice chairman a woman called Joanne Davidson, who'd been Speaker of the House in Ohio, who had been the president's chair of the president's reelect in a critical part of Ohio, which, of course, was a critical state. And he chose her because of her hard work and because of her organizational skills. But she happens to be pro-choice. And that choice, his choice of her, unleashed an enormous amount of email and pushback from this group that I would call a social fundamentalist, who said, you can't possibly have someone who's pro-choice. This is a terrible thing to do. The president had to intervene in order to have Joanne become the vice chairwoman. But what's more, even more sort of offensive to me and sends the message they don't really care about people who feel differently, she had to agree not to appear before any pro-choice fundraising efforts. Now, I applaud Ken Melman for having reached out to her. I think he's trying to make some baby steps, but the pressure, the pushback, and the capitulation to it is what troubles me greatly. And I think that as moderates, we got to stand up and say, this is just unacceptable.
So he got her, but he got her in kind of a box. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you tonight?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind, David?
Well, I'm a lifelong Democrat, but I still wish Governor Whitman well in her efforts. But I wanted to suggest that this whole ownership society rhetoric creates an enormous opportunity for her and moderate Republicans, as it does for Democrats, too.
How so? How so, David?
Well, because, you know, first of all, I don't believe Bush's use of that rhetoric. You know, I think he's using this whole ownership society idea to destroy Social Security. And if he really meant it, you know, he wouldn't be forcing the country to make a choice, you know, either Social Security or ownership. I mean, David Brooks came out with a suggestion the other day, bringing back a suggestion from Senator Bob Kerry about KidSave.
Give every American a few thousand dollars at birth, invest it for a lifetime.
But there are all sorts of other ideas along those lines that would galvanize a huge, moderate consensus in this country, where you could be achieving, you know, large social aims, basically using conservative Republican means.
We got it. Let us pick it up. Our time is short. Christy Todd Whitman, where are you on the president's Social Security proposal and the ownership society?
Well, I think this may be one issue where moderates do have a very good opportunity to be heard and be the deciding voice in the debate, because this is not going to go easily for the president, what he has proposed, and it's going to be the subject of a great deal of debate, and thoughtful debate on this is what we need. You know, I don't have a constitutional opposition to allowing people to invest a small portion of their Social Security in a private investment account, as long as you're very careful about how you constrain that and what kind of safety net you have under it. You could also say that the best thing for Social Security is to really have a lockbox and say Congress can't take any of the interest from the Social Security Trust Fund and spend it on anything other than Social Security. If you leave it there, there'll probably be enough money. But this is the kind of discussion, we shouldn't be afraid of having this discussion. We should welcome it and have a very vigorous discussion and make sure all sides are heard.
Once again, kind of endorsing the president and kind of glancing off in a different direction.
Well, because I have to tell you, I mean, I've listened to what he said. I haven't seen his proposal. I don't know that anybody has seen the meat and bones of it. And until you've seen that, you really don't know what you're talking about.
Mark's calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Governor Whitman, I heard you say a few moments ago that the social conservatives are not open-minded to having moderates in the party. I am one, and I feel I and many of us are open. I think it's a strength of the Republican Party that they can have people like Giuliani, yourself, and Schwarzenegger. I even point to the California support for Schwarzenegger, where he did elicit some social conservative support in winning the governor's seat there. But second, to point toward Hillary Rodham Clinton garnered a lot of attention here recently, the Roe versus Wade anniversary, as she expressed her abortion rights support, but then came toward the middle more, and a lot of people in conservative talk radio said, well, she's doing that to position herself for 08 and moving toward the middle.
Well, she said, let's minimize abortion, she said.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So but various hosts were saying she's trying to paint herself a little bit more centrist on that. I wonder if you, as an abortion rights supporting Republican, are willing to be more conciliatory as well.
And what would that mean? What would conciliatory mean to you, Mark?
Well, for her, I mean, I've heard her talk a lot about that, and it sounds near and dear to her. I just wonder if Clinton is trying to seek to minimize abortion. I haven't heard Whitman express that so far.
Okay, you can now.
Yeah, Mark, first of all, let me say, I don't think you fall in, just from the way you talk, you don't fall into the social fundamentalist category. You are maybe a social conservative, and that's fine. Thinking conservatives like you, and I'm conservative on a bunch of issues, we're needed. We all part of the party, and we are accepting of the fact there are people who think differently than we do. As a governor, I funded abstinence education. I believe in abstinence is the only way to ensure you don't have an unwanted pregnancy and that you don't get a socially transmitted disease. I don't believe you ought to just teach abstinence. You have to recognize that kids, unfortunately, don't always follow the advice of their elders, so you need to teach them some other things. But beginning and ending with abstinence is fine, and we funded it. We also funded programs that would help girls who got pregnant outside of wedlock but felt they couldn't bring that child to term because they couldn't live at home, give them a place to go, to give them the support to bring the child to term. And in fact, and I go into this in the book, there was a time on a partial birth abortion bill that came my way that I couldn't sign because it was unconstitutional, but I used the power that only the governor of New Jersey at that point anyway had, called a constitutional veto. I rewrote that bill that would have, for the first time, put restrictions on third trimester abortions in the state of New Jersey. And it wasn't – I was overridden by the legislature because they wanted the bill the way they'd written it, even though I knew it was unconstitutional. They spent $500,000 of the taxpayers' money defending it, even though their own lawyers told them it was unconstitutional, and it was determined to be unconstitutional. So there's now no restriction in New Jersey. But I actually wrote legislation that would have put some restrictions on, but would have also recognized that a woman doesn't stop being a person just because she gets pregnant. And when the life and physical health of the mother is at stake, that's got to be a reason for consideration.
So pro-choice, but also putting that middle ground out there. Christy Todd Whitman, we've just got a minute left here. How serious is this challenge, this conflict within inside the Republican Party? How critical?
I think it's very critical. And we are at a point now, because we have no heir apparent waiting to step forward who is the obvious choice of the party. So by having the discussion, you're not necessarily undermining the party's candidate, whom everyone has already acknowledged. This is the time to do it. And I know so many Republicans who are saying, if it doesn't change, I just can't keep voting Republican, and I'm not going to. And the country is closely enough divided. Our election victories have been narrow enough that we better be very careful. We cannot afford to lose conservatives or moderates or liberals in our party. We have to have all of us.
Sounds like a big challenge. We'll be following closely. Christy Todd Whitman, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Christy Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey, former EPA administrator in Bush's first term, author of It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, one of the country's most prominent female business leaders is sacked. This is On Point. Hewlett-Packard's board of directors has forced out chief executive Carly Fiorina after a rocky five-and-a-half-year tenure. Fiorina was one of America's highest-profile executives, both because she was one of only eight women leading Fortune 500 companies and because of her bold, some say brash, style of decision-making. She pushed through a $19 billion merger with Compaq in 2002 that yielded only mediocre results. Her fiercest critic was Walter Hewlett, the son of Hewlett-Packard's late co-founder. Today's news of her resignation sent HP's stock up 7%. Nancy Kane is professor at Harvard Business School and joins me now for some insight into today's announcement. Nancy Kane, thanks for being with us tonight.
Pleasure, Tom.
How are you interpreting the downfall of Carly Fiorina?
Well, I think this chapter in Carly's life is primarily about a change in strategy. The board has announced that that's not what's governing the request for her resignation, but looking at the stock performance, looking at the company's market share, looking at its profitability over the last 3 years since the merger, one has to think that this is a company whose big bet, Compaq plus HP, one plus one would equal three, didn't pay off the way investors, employees, and management wanted.
So she deserved the boot?
Yeah. A CEO simply has to be responsible to the fortunes, the competitive fortunes of a company. And Carly Fiorina staked a huge amount on that 2002 merger, a very contentious merger, incidentally, for reasons that you alluded to, Tom. And, you know, the bet didn't pay off. I think this is not about Carly as a human being. It's about a business leader whose fortunes are tied up with a company, and that company is, it doesn't look as good as management and stock and stockholders, and I'm sure a number of employees wish it did.
So in business terms, how do you think the strategy failed? What was she promising or hoping for? What didn't happen?
She wanted to create the world's largest, most successful technology company. So she wanted to put PCs together with the technology and innovation of Hewlett-Packard's business in printers and other high-tech services to deliver a set of integrated sort of one-stop shopping solutions to business and household consumers. It's a big, ambitious vision. IBM's been in this game much more successfully for a lot longer since Lou Gerstner took over at the company in 1992 and continuing today. And at the same time, she had to compete, with, at least in the PC business, with very, very savvy, very smart, very successful players like Dell in a cutthroat commodity business where margins are razor thin. And I simply think that the combination of the vision and the execution and the competition, was too much for the company, for Carly, and ultimately for the board.
Very hard for anybody to end up at the top of one of these Fortune 500 companies, particularly if the evidence is any guide for a woman. What was the arc of her career, the character of her personality that put her in that high, high position?
It's a great question. She is a very savvy, very smart, very driven executive. She really came up through AT&T and then at Lucent. She championed and spearheaded the spinoff of Lucent Technologies from AT&T and made her mark there in sales. She has enormous talent at selling, at marketing, at talking to customers, at understanding what they want. To even today, as CEO of Hewlett-Packard, she spends a huge amount of her time on the road with customers. She's a very, very competent, indeed brilliant salesperson. And I think that, and she's a very charismatic woman, a very attractive woman, a very intelligent woman, all those things served her very well, as indeed they would serve any man in the CEO position in sort of taking her up the ladder to be the head of literally the most important woman in terms of leading a computer company in the history of capitalism.
And yet she wasn't a man, and she was in a kind of a boys' club, man's world. How did gender factor into this whole story, her perceptions about Carly?
That's a really interesting question. I think, business historians will sort of chew on that for a number of years, and we'll probably never know the real answer. I'm sure she had to work harder, as any woman at the top does, as women do at many ranks in corporate America, than her male counterparts to run that company, to prove herself, to talk to her investors and help them understand what she was doing. I think she was served much better by her sales talents, by her sense of possibility, by her really motivating way of leading. She's a real motivational leader inside and outside the company. I think those were her chief assets, and I'm not sure, Tom, in the end, they're gender specific. Whether she took a harder hit by Wall Street at the merger and beyond because she was a woman, that's a really interesting question. There's probably some, again, kind of unquantifiable factor there that she had to work against, swim upstream a bit, because she's a woman in a man's world.
But the merger didn't work, and there are a lot of mergers going on right now. We'll be watching to see how some of those work out. Nancy Kane at Harvard Business School, always great having you with us. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Real pleasure.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.